Fashion number 11607, Joe Neighbours, Reel 2.
Is that it?
Can you think of any particular missions that were most demanding for you, most difficult? Do any come to mind? I know it's been a long time.
Yeah, I think the one that I am thinking about was going to Leyte. I think I went to Leyte, and they were bombing. I can still see the Navy ships bombing the harbor. Both, they were bombing our Navy ships and the Navy, and we, I don't even remember. I think we had a Red Cross, but they weren't acknowledging or,
there was no Geneva Convention.
There was no convention. There was, and we had, they were shooting at us, and this really did, I was panicky. And I, when we landed and we got our load of patients and started back out, I was never so glad to leave an island as I was that day. I think that was D-Day plus 10 or 11. I can't remember. Then, yeah.
Can you think of any way that you were able to deal with that? Because once you got your patients on board, then I'm guessing that you had to be very
calm and cool and smile and tell little jokes. And we had, as I said, we had no flight surgeon on our flights with us. We had a clerk, male, what we call male. They'd call them aid. Today they'd call them orderlies,
okay.
I guess, you know. Uh-huh. But it would be a, he would
an
be on the plane.
Person.
It was an enlisted mm-hmm. person. He was a sergeant. He was a medical corpsman. And so he would be on the plane to help if you needed any help. But on this plane I had, I remember the chest wound that I had. And he had an open, and we had to go up pretty high to get out of the ACAC firing. Uh-huh. And so we were up pretty high and he began bleeding.
And these are unpressurized.
These
cabins
are unpressurized
too.
Cabins. Uh-huh. No, well, I don't. No, we didn't have pressurized cabins.
That's what I was saying.
Unpressurized.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said they were No, we had unpressurized cabins, and so his wound began bleeding, and I thought, oh, what'll I do? What'll I do? So we did. I did give him some morphine because he was having pain and complaining. I sat him up. We had the little oxygen mask with the tank.
Uh-huh.
I put that on him, and then I had to replug his wound, replug the chest wound to stop the bleeding. So we were flying from Guam to Leyte, and that really, I was never so glad to get back to a base as I was then. And when I showed the flight surgeon, and I couldn't understand, but flight surgeons never flew on the trips.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got back and Captain Flynn was at Guam, I showed him the wound and showed him what I did, and he said, that's what you're supposed to do. He said, that's why you're a flight nurse.
Well, great.
Any emergency that comes up, you have to do it. Well, all I could think of was if we were shot down, Judy, I was deathly afraid that I'd have to ditch first and then save myself and then try to save all these boys. And
uh-huh,
I thought,
uh-huh.
I can't do that. I can't go out there in that water and let these boys go down with this airplane.
So that was going through your mind?
That was going through my mind. And, of course, I was Catholic and I had rosary beads. And my family sent me pairs of rosary beads every day. And every time I went out on a flight, I think I wore out about 10 pair of rosary beads.
So that must have seen you through some of the difficult days.
Saw me through many of the difficult missions.
Uh-huh.
We had a lot of difficult missions.
Did you ever lose a patient?
Yes. Yes. I lost a little blind boy that was only 18 years old. I just felt so bad because he didn't know what he was going to do when he got home. He didn't want to see his family, didn't want to see anybody.
Uh-huh.
And he just had no will to live. And I sat beside that boy, and I think I cried and cried with him. That, you know, they say nurses are hard, but we aren't hard. I cried and cried with that boy, and when we got him in, I found out he didn't die on me, but he was near death. And he got the next flight that went right, the next nurse that took him out, he died.
He didn't die on
me. Didn't die on me. He didn't die. But I knew, you know, he had all the symptoms of dying because he didn't respond too much after we talked for a few minutes. He'd given up his will to live, and he just didn't want to go home. And I felt so bad. 18 years old, and how he ever got into the service, he lied about his age. And this is what he was afraid of. What was his family going to say? Quite upset about it. Little boy that came from Vermont. Vermont.
Made the comment about some people think that the nurses are hard, and I would guess that, you know, certainly sometimes we have to be hard, act hard, or look hard.
Well, look
but
hard.
But there are the other times when there's nothing hard about.
No, I think when you have to put on an exterior calm and joke about things that aren't really funny. And you have to show, put this appearance on when deep down inside you're really crying harder than these boys are. I mean, you feel for them, and I did feel for them, and yet you'd have to joke with them because you couldn't let them know that you felt this way.
Well, there certainly certain kinds of patients that were especially difficult in that sense for you to, cool, calm, and collected?
Because every time, patients would look at you if you had, lots of times we had a lot of disturbance and turbulence. And you would drop, say, 1,000 feet. And believe me, you'd see all the back where we had our rations and things would be bouncing all over the place because you can't strap them down too well. But all the patients, you have them in the litters and you have them strapped down. Even those become bouncy. And then we'd also, some of the wounded would be sitting up because they didn't have enough room for all of them to be laid out on stretchers. So you'd have to go to them and see that they were strapped in and smile at them. And tell them that, it's all right. And there you are, and spread your legs out because otherwise you'd be flying yourself and you'd hang on to both sides because
your broad base of support,
on each side of the litter because the C-54s were very narrow. They weren't that big. So you'd have you'd have patients on stretchers on one side and stretchers on the other side, mm-hmm. and then you'd stand in the middle. Now, I don't know whether you had those, but we did.
Had what?
The C-54s.
No,
you said you didn't.
Well,
you
had did not fly. I've never flown on a C-54.
And they're not very safe. When you hear all this, and you'd hear all the noise, they're tinny. Tinny inside. If you think these little commuters, they rattle like mad. You'd think, they're not padded and nice and soft like they are today, that you don't hear any of this outside noise. And, of course, we didn't have any, we did have oxygen tanks, with the little mask, but we had nothing coming in, no oxygen coming in or anything. And, as I said, no pressurized areas, no lighting except, at nighttime we didn't have any lights because we weren't allowed to have lights on. It was mostly blackouts, even flying the airplane.
So you're doing a lot of it in the dark or by feeling or touching more than being able to maybe see some of your...
But it wasn't all depressing or sad because there were many times we flew at nighttime and it would be about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and you'd see the most beautiful sunsets. The captain would call you up front and he'd say, now this is something you have to see, and it was beautiful. Really made you feel like, what a beautiful world. And you'd go back and you'd have a lot of these patients, very few of them, they were serious. A lot of amputees, and a lot of, as I said, we had a lot of chest wounds and a lot of this. And they were, and then he'd have an appendectomy, like I said, that he got up and ate all my sea rations while I went up front. He was so hungry, he said. He just had surgery that day when they put him on my airplane. And they said, now he's to go back and stay at Hickam. Well, he said he was hungry. The boys didn't even think about it. They went ahead and left him go back there and eat all. He got out of his stretcher and went back there and got the food and went back and lay down and ate peaches, peanut butter, and sea rations. The biscuits, what I used to call dog biscuits.
Did he have any problems?
No problems at all. Felt wonderful. And, I think about it. And here, look at how we do appendixes today. And they get out. The children get up and go. And hernias are home now in a day. So I guess it wasn't... At that time, though, it was serious, and I thought, if he rips that incision, I'll die.
I bet you had some time
I worried
to
about
worry
that.
About
I did.
That
I thought about it
over.
Before it was over.
Yeah. But did you feel like your training had prepared you for the types of duties that you then took on?
Not all of them. No, we never practiced anything. They never said anything about what do you do about an amputee. If it bleeds, what happens to the stump? What do you do about the patient that's complaining? What do you do about chest wounds that are open that you have no way of suturing? What are you supposed to do? I didn't think we had enough training as far as psychologically, the mental attitude of the patients, of the soldiers. Although I did take some, I did work on the mental ward at Keesler Field for 3 months, I think. But I still didn't feel that these boys in the battlefield had a different problem than they did in the States, mentally. I think these boys were depressed, they were wounded, and some of them did not want to go back into battlefields, some of them thought they would never live, some of them thought they'd never be able to walk, some of them did not want to go home. They were wondering what was going to happen to them, what was going to happen to their buddies. A lot of them had their buddies killed right there with them in the trenches. So there were a lot of problems, and I didn't feel that we were qualified to accept, to listen, to have compassion, listen to their problems. I couldn't direct them. I didn't feel that I could say to them, all I could do was say, well, give them hope and they'll take care of you when you get back there and you won't have to worry. You know, they may not send you back. Now, a lot of our minor wounds gave me more problems than those that were serious because we used to call them the gold breakers.
Yeah, I know they have terms for that today,
yes.
too, the million-dollar injuries or
yes.
something like that.
Oh, mm-hmm. they gave us problems.
The way you were able to resolve this then was just like you said, trying to give some of these patients hope and just being there to
just being there to listen to them, I think. I think that in itself was probably the... I think they looked toward to the flight nurse to give them this type of encouragement, you know, and if we didn't show any fear or disdain or I don't know how to say it, mm-hmm. but I think if we just showed them that we had love for them, I think, and we did care about what happened to them.
I have heard a lot about the morale effect of the flight nurses during World War II, and some of that even had to do with your own personal grooming.
Yes, we had to look nice, we had to be dressed nice, our hair always had to be done right, and before we came in, we had to go and put lipstick on, you know, before you picked up a flight of patients, we had to be all groomed, we had to smile, we had to smell nice, that's true, we did, and we were there for a morale booster also, because I think they'd like to see some American girls, after all, they'd been on the islands for so long that they hadn't, didn't know what we all looked like, and I think they were happy to see mm-hmm. flight nurses all prettied up with permanents and their hair done and smiling and their eyelashes all taken care of. Yeah, I think that was one of our, well, that was one of the prime requisites, I think, to be a flight nurse. You had to be well-groomed, well, I guess, nice-looking. Didn't expect us to be beautiful, I don't think so, but we had to know how to wear our hair and wear our makeup and
make yourself look nice,
to make ourselves
to work
with what we had. Yes.
Did you find that a problem as far as where you were? Were you able to get your makeup and your hair done?
Well, see, no. I always washed my own hair in my helmet. I'll be honest with you. When we hit from island, we very seldom got to Hickam Field that often.
Yeah.
So that we
out in these different islands.
In these different islands, when we'd go to Saipan or Tarawa or any, we'd always brought our supplies from Hickam. But, of course, we didn't have curling irons then, and we didn't have any of that, but we did have rollers. We'd put our rollers up, but I was lucky my hair wasn't that... I had a little curl to my hair, so I never had to worry about getting a permit or anything.
Uh-huh.
So I just used my... we'd stick the bucket out and get some rainwater and wash our hair. That's the way we took our spit baths. Yes, before we went on flights. You know, we would be in these tents, and that's where we'd live. And there would be maybe two or three nurses in a Quonset hut, say on Saipan, uh-huh. and they would all each be sent to different areas to pick up patients. And there were many nights we slept in there alone, in these Quonset huts on these islands. And you know, you worry because there's all these insects and all these two-legged animals that come in. And no lights.
Uh-huh.
So you didn't dare. I remember once on... I can't remember what island it was, but we had an outdoor shower. And the shower was a large drum, and it had holes in it. I don't know whether you had that also, but anyhow,
no,
it
but
had
I
a little...
No, heard about these.
And it was a nice little area, and of course, they would always say to us, the officer, whoever was there on the base, would say, it's your time from 5 to 6 to go. Any other flight nurses, you're to go to take your showers, you know. And it was the same shower that everybody used.
It's a community shower.
Community shower. So mm-hmm. this one time I was in there taking a shower and went to rinse the water and I see a face up there. Well, I screamed and of course everybody came running. It was one of the fellows who hadn't seen a white woman for so long. So from then on we wore bathing suits in the shower. We would not take a shower anymore. It was like on Canton, I think it was Captain Dwyer said that he found the guys had put knot holes in the outhouse so they could peek in there.
It almost sounds like y'all never had any real privacy.
We didn't. There was never privacy, no. Mm. We never had that much privacy, no. I'll have to say that. It was like a large community living. You had no bathroom facilities for yourself. As I said, Kwajalein Army nurses gave us two rooms to use on the base. That's what and their name of their island was Hell's Angel, their Quonset hut.
I've seen the picture with that.
Yes, with that insignia. And we had the last rooms, and it was by the ocean, and it was beautiful there. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And there was a bathroom on that. Well, but they were all Army nurses, so we didn't mind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the time Martha Tilton and Francis Langford and somebody else came, and we had 11 o'clock at night. We'd come in at 9 o'clock, all ready to go. We had to evacuate and go sleep someplace else to give them our rooms, which I didn't think was very nice. We were doing a very good job. Of course, they were USO tour, too, but I thought there were plenty of other places for them to go to bed. And, of course, Martha Tilton didn't have a shampoo, it was, and she didn't have toothpaste, and they asked if we couldn't leave. They asked, but we knew what they meant. It would be there the next day. Another command performance. We were so accustomed to that we just left it and went on. Yeah. And that's where I met a girl from Youngstown was there. That had graduated the year after I did, was stationed at...
She was an Army nurse there?
She was an Army nurse there, yeah, Ann Shimura. And the chief nurse, when the chief nurse found out that we were friends, they were very nice. They gave us food. They left us go in and sit in their mess and eat and everything. But they were very nice to Eileen and I.
When you had these different kinds of quarters, were you all able to kind of fix them up or something?
Oh, no. They were temporary quarters. They were all temporary. They had cots in them. No, we had nothing. The bathroom, as I said, we'd go down there. There was a mirror there, and there would be a shower, like Kwajalein. They were still Quonset huts, like uh-huh. built with metal. But no, we were never able to bring it. We never had a home life atmosphere, as I said to you.
That was only back at Hickam.
That was at Hickam Field, and as I said, we didn't get back to Hickam very often.
I wondered if maybe y'all had fixed up this little Quonset hut so nicely that it was the prettiest place to put these USO.
No, it wasn't. No, but I think they just thought they couldn't throw out the regular nurses with all their clothes and everything there, and we were the only ones that just had the small bags that could pick up and move, and I think that was
so
the reason for that. They threw out the flight nurses. We were always that way.
Does anything come to mind as the most, maybe the most difficult thing that you had to contend with during, you know, your assignment as a flight nurse during the war?
I think the most difficult thing, it wasn't during the war, it was July. I was flying a load of patients from Okinawa back. In fact, we were going to go direct. And I had heard, we'd seen or heard about the bomb. And at the time when they said they bombed Japan, they had annihilated two cities. We had heard and that everybody was dead, that this bomb was so deadly. In fact, that was the first time I'd ever heard of the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
We had never even thought about it, but they said... It was. And I really, you know, with my faith that I thought, my faith got me all through the war, and my faith and my rosary beads got me everywhere. And I thought, how could this ever happen? How could they produce a bomb that would annihilate this many people?
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, was the worst. I've seen a lot and had treated a lot and almost crash-landed one time right on the side of the waters we came into one of the islands. Never was frightened, but I was frightened that day. I think I was the most frightened person. In fact, I think some of my patients, I must have... the look on my face must have really frightened them, too, because some of them said to me, Lieutenant, what's the matter?
Must have kind of betrayed your feelings.
And I think that's the first time I showed my feelings, and I said to them, the one fellow said to me, well, you should be happy the war is over.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I am happy for that, because I said that means that many less boys that are wounded, our boys can go back home and it will be all over. But I said, just think if that bomb had bombed New York or had taken another big city. I said, how would you feel if it was your family?
Yeah.
I said, I don't know these people, but I said, my heart aches for these people because of this bomb. And I felt that way to this day, and I hope that nothing like this ever happens again.
So this wasn't just a fleeting thought, but
no,
something
this has been something after that day. That from then until October, I think it was, we had our point system. I flew many missions, and as I said, It was after that, I think, that I became angry at this squadron leader who told me I had to go back out again, and I had been flying back and forth, and after that, I just couldn't take any more that I had gone to the commander and asked to...
That was the time you got, like, an R&R or something.
R&R for 10 days up in the island of Hawaii, mm-hmm. up at the top, yes. Mm-hmm. Very
and
nice time.
How did you feel after you finished the...
Wonderful. It was the greatest time. That was vacation time, and I hated to come back. But when I got back, I was told, let's see, that would have been August, and I was told that if I had enough points, I could go back to the States. And then they said to us, no, you can't go back until your replacement comes. Uh-huh. And there was another squadron that was due over, and I think that squadron came October the 14th or 15th, and I can't remember, but it was in October. And the nicest feeling was to fly back to San Francisco and see the Golden Gate.
Oh,
what a feeling. We cried. Oh, no. Tell him it was the Golden Gate. It was foggy, but it was beautiful. Do you know it used to take us 14 hours to fly from San Francisco to Hickam and back? From one way.
14 hours each way.
Each way.
Uh-huh.
Each way.
Uh-huh.
It was terrible. And I can still remember I took a load of patients from the Philippines all the way to off along the way and pick up other patients, stayed on the plane, and came all the way. That time I came to San Francisco and had a delay en route. That took almost 2 days. Well, that would be because we had a day. I think there was a change of time.
Well, you crossed
the international line, and that's why it took us 2 days.
Line.
That's right, because the day I arrived was the same day that I had left.
That's right.
That's
yeah.
what happened.
Yeah, you lose.
You lose, and I just, and you know, now
you
that
lose
I,
the day going
you lose,
over and
you gain it going back.
So it could, you could get there at the same time.
Yes, but mm-hmm. when I think about jet lag, I think, my gosh, we must have had jet lag all the time, plane lag, because we flew hours and hours and hours, according to this, my gosh, all over the place. Look at this.
This
I made
is
this
your
all.
Flight log.
This was
now,
my flight log with my own.
Had to annotate yeah, that had all of your hours.
Now I could tell you where when we left and where it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, Canton. January the 22nd, we were at Canton. That, we must have started, must have been Christmas time we arrived because we started right away. So it couldn't have been.
Didn't you say around the 10th of December?
10th of December, but what did I do from the 10th on? I know we didn't sit there. I don't remember.
You probably found something to keep you busy.
13th, 16th. Well, they flew us around because here's all these from the 13th of December to the 31st. I have flight logs and the times.
Mm-hmm.
See, they were non-rated. You flew, but you didn't bring patients back. That's what they meant. See, they marked ours rated or non-rated.
So certain flights you got the credit for, like towards
if
what,
you went
towards the airport.
We only got oh yeah, so
you had
to have patience and you had to have certain many hours. So we got the air medal that we got. So these are all I think times of that logged for patient logs.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So that well, 1 month I think I had 22 days that I flew with patients.
Oh,
non-logging time. I meant as far as.
Really
patient law, and that was when, that was one of the flights that I said about coming back from, I don't remember when the A-bomb was. Was it in July 15th or August 15th or something? I can't remember, but I do know it was a sad day for me. That, I would say, would have been about the saddest day for me.
Now you mentioned an almost crash landing.
Oh, that, yes.
I guess it worked out okay, but I bet
well,
a while there it was kind of...
We were coming in,
scary,
and
maybe.
The one engine went out. And one of my patients, and I was busy, I think, getting him something to eat, and one of my boys that was laying on the litter yelled and said, nurse, there's no wing out here. And I said, what do you mean there's no wing? And he said, I don't see the propeller or anything. And I thought, oh, he's crazy. He must be having delusions. He's delirious. I went out and looked, and I ran up to the cabin, and I said to the pilot, you know you lost one wing. The propeller.
The propeller
was gone. The wing was there.
The wing was there, but the propeller was
he
out.
Couldn't see. And he said to me, what are you talking about? And I said, you've lost your propeller on that wing. And he said to me, we couldn't have him. Well, he went back, and he checked. And so we had all strap in, and he started his descent. And he said, we may make it, but we may have to ditch. When you have to ditch, that means you have to be get your life raft. We practice that a lot, yeah, and get that out, and you blow that all up and get everything all set, and then you start bringing the patients down. And I thought, oh, dear Lord, that's, I really broke a pair of rosary beads.
I wore those rosary beads out,
smiling at the patients, and I said, you don't have anything to worry about. And I'm sitting there because we all are strapped in, and I'm thinking, oh, boy, we better make it, we better make it. Well, when we started and the descent was down, and when I saw the water, I thought, we're not going to make it, we're not going to make it. We got right to the edge. Our tail, I think, hit the bottom of the water.
Oh.
And, of course, then we did the wheels came and we screeched and everything. And here's all these trucks coming up to make sure that it didn't catch on fire right away.
Right.
And so we could get us all out and get us up down who brought the thing? And we opened up the door right away and everybody says, get out, get out. And I thought, I can't get out. I got a load of patients in here.
Uh-huh.
Get out, Mrs. Neighbors. You have to get out. And this was Captain Dwyer. And he said, you're not allowed to stay in that airplane. He said, you're more valuable than all those boys in that airplane. He said, you're not that expendable. And that was the attitude all during the South Pacific. If anything happened to your airplane, you must remember, the crew and the flight nurse are the most important people on this airplane.
That was their philosophy of saving yourself first.
And then if you can save some of the others, fine. But you must save yourself first in order to help the others.
No wonder in that the mission you were telling about earlier, where you said it went through your mind what you would do.
I don't know if this is the same mission, but if y'all were in the kitchen,
you had to get out and then get back in and get your patients out.
Well, one girl did on one of the islands. She had a patient that had to have a tracheotomy, and she had to use whatever means she had, a rubber tubing that she had in there, plus the knife, pen knife that was in our box, and she used mm-hmm. that and put a tube in there, but she had to ditch, and she did have to get her patients out. She was fortunate; she only had four patients that were not able to get out on their own. That she had to get out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you had some close calls, but never actually did a ditching in the ocean.
No.
I'm going to guess that y'all were close enough to some island to know that you could.
Saipan.
It was Saipan. That you stood a good chance of getting in there.
Yes, because see, there wasn't. Let's see, from Manila, from Guam and Saipan and Tarawa, these were the Marshall Islands, Kwajalein and Tarawa. There wasn't that much distance that you could say maybe a 4, 5, 6 hour difference, mm-hmm. In flight time. But from Guam to Leyte and Guam to Okinawa, there was a long distance. So, the flight that I'm talking about our almost having to ditch was from. It was one of the Marshall Islands, from Tarawa, I think, to Saipan, to Kwajalein,
uh-huh.
or Saipan to Kwajalein. So those were all atolls. They weren't really islands.
Yeah.
They were all sand atolls. There was no green.
Some type of landing strip on them.
Oh, yes, they all had little, but our planes were small,
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been able to take any large.